from the Skinny D Media Archives.
Hello, can you hear me? Hey, how's it going, Mr. Michael Colville Anderson?
Michael, not Mr. More about the Mr. shit.
That's just me liking to be formal. How do you do yourself? I'm a great fan of Life Size City and a lot of your work.
Thanks very much. That's cool, man.
Hey, you're more than welcome there. We definitely have quite a few questions to talk about with you today. I know things have been quite difficult right now because of the pandemic. You haven't been able to travel about and also talk about your work, your activism, recycling and the environment. But definitely this will give a different perspective for things for people who feel like, oh, I'm kind of stuck. Maybe they can do something within their home setting. You never know.
You never know. Is that a question?
Hey, it could be rhetorical one way or another. I'll put it that way. I'm just so happy to have you on board discussing all these things here. So we'll start with the first one in regards to travel experience. Because I'm aware from your TV show and also through the website that you mainly started promoting cycling and also more environmentally friendly means of transport. How did that come about? Ever since you were a child or later in life?
Oh, it happened pretty randomly. I was working in film and television, and then I did a lot of street photography. And I just took a picture one day back in 2006 and put it onto Flickr, where I had a big following. And it was just a regular Copenhagener on a bike. You know, it's not even a great photo. But all of these people started reacting to it, mostly from the U.S., you know, saying, whoa, how does she ride a bike in a skirt? You know, how is that possible? Like, and I realized, well, I didn't realize anything then. I just thought it was really weird because that's what you do in a bicycle-friendly city like Copenhagen. You just ride your bike to work just like this, you know. So I started taking more and more photos of elegantly dressed Copenhageners and kept uploading them, kept getting a reaction. And then in, 2007, I realized, you know, this is a thing. This is still weird, man, but it's a thing. And it was also 2007 where it was kind of the perfect storm. Everybody was starting blogs for the first time. The whole microblogging thing kind of showed up. And I said, oh, fine, I'll start a blog. So I have like kind of a gallery for these photos that people seem to like, you know, whatever. And then it was also the phase in fashion about street style. You know, everybody was taking photos of people on the streets around the world. Like, what are you wearing today? And so this blog just exploded in my face. And the whole way through, the viewers of the blog were women. So I kind of started a fashion blog without ever having, you know, any idea that I was starting a fashion blog. And, having a lot of women around the world reacting to like, wow, this is, you can just ride a bike in your regular clothes and your heels and your fancy dress on a Friday night or whatever. So that was interesting to have that target group all of a sudden. So I just kept going with that. And then I started thinking, I'm also a journalist. I'm thinking like, why is this a thing, man? And then I started another blog called CopenhagenEyes.com and started looking into how did Copenhagen get to this, you know, to be the best city in the world for cycling. And then I just kept falling down the rabbit hole, man, like Alice in Wonderland. You know, I realized at some point, this is what I got to do now. And then that just sort of led to urbanism, thinking about cities, you know, because I'm not educated as a planner, even though I have been working as one for 10 years, more than 10 years. So I just sort of come at this like from left field with a fresh look and that's what I do today. And then the TV series came along. It was the most obvious thing. The book I wrote, you know, it all just sort of happened because, you know, you've been staring at one thing for that long. You know, the opportunities to take it further are very many, you know?
Oh, yes, of course there. It's definitely an inspirational route for many young people who feel like, I'm kind of at my breaking point. Therefore, I should thrive and go and do something. I know I was kind of like with that because, prior to my YouTube channel, Skinny E Media, I was mostly doing film reviews and music reviews for the local newspapers. I was at university and in a local town. And I expanded on through the internet and then through Twitter and Instagram to try to increase my presence. And now I even have you on board to discuss environmentalism and cycling, and also travel and culture. You have definitely been an inspiration to me in many ways. Ever since Anthony Bourdain died, God rest his soul, there hasn't been much avenues to go for except for Rick Steves and Samantha Brown and Michael Palin. And then you came on board through TV Ontario Knowledge Network and in the US, Link TV. And I thought, wow, this is one of the greatest programs I can see right now. This is better than Game of Thrones. No offense if you're a fan. I love travel shows. It's what I breathe for.
Yeah, it's funny because, I mean, you know, it's a travel show, I guess. I don't think about it like that. I think about it as urbanism. And then I'm all over the world. So I guess it's a travel show. So yeah, you know, again, like it wasn't set out to become a travel show. It was set out to become an inspirational program about what people are doing, regular citizens in cities around the world. So yeah, I guess when you say it, I'm going, wow, I literally never thought about it as a travel show, but it is, of course, now that you say it.
Well, some of tabloids, I think it was, Globe and Mail or National Post or McLean's, they said you were the Anthony Bourdain of urbanism. I thought that was a clever way to promote yourself one way or another. And I thought, okay, now I have to see this because the reason how I've heard of you, Mr. MCA, is it okay if I call you MCA? Was they had an ad for you go to Toronto to visit the TTC, their transit authority. And I thought, because I love Canada, which is why I'm wearing Alex Trebek, the late game show host, who was more popular in America, but he was definitely an inspiration to me as well. And talking about the systems and links and North America being a bit lagging behind, and also connectivity through different neighborhoods that are more poor, more rich. And I think that's a very important tool to focus on. Also, even in your New Orleans episode, where you talk about the economic and racial divide, I think that is a very important issue to discuss, because I know in our politics, it seems like we have everything under the control, but I think with COVID, that broke apart and shattered into a million pieces and stabbed you into your skin.
Yeah, yeah. Cities, man, I mean, cities, that's what makes the program, you know, the series interesting, because cities are complex. They're incredibly organic, but it's not just like, you know, do we have a bike lane, you know, or do we have, a walkable city? It's all of these things, you know, racial diversity, the issues about, you know, wage and age and race. And I mean, there's so many complex issues in cities and, there's no easy answer to any of it. But generally, somewhere in the world, which is what I want to show with the Life-Size City, somebody's probably doing some good work on that topic, you know. Maybe here in Denmark, we don't have as many issues with racial inequality as in the United States, you know, but so you go there and you talk to people who are doing stuff or people figuring out climate change adaptation solutions, you know, I mean, oh, that works in Mexico City. Well, oh man, you know, that might work over there in Cape Town where they have the same problem. So, you know, sort of bringing all of these, like the spider's web in a way, that's what the Life-Size City is. Connecting people. Now, in my industry, we all kind of know each other, right? You know, that guy in Mexico City, he's doing some good work. Heard about him, in my silo. But then, you know, the regular people watching this program, you know, they don't know anything, you know, about urbanism, and we're drawing them in, making them realize that it's their city and they should have a voice. And, you know, they can activate their neighbors and go out and do stuff and force, you know, the city to act, you know, put pressure on the politicians and whatnot. So for me, the Life-Size City is really like, hey guys, we're all in this together, living in cities, and there's a lot of great thought and effort being put into it. And maybe there's something in Toronto that will work in Tokyo and so on.
I would agree with you there, because it almost seems like for many people, they feel like they can't climb up the ladder because of economic or social influences or lobbying and corruption from their government saying, hey, you can't be doing that. But some people find ways to even manage in times of crisis. And I would definitely like to see you, I don't know, with the financing and all the business talks that are going on between you and your team, you see in the post-pandemic or during pandemic with a mask to see how things are being changed in terms of the changing climate of urbanism and cycling and environmental action. Because right now it may seem like, because we're driving less cars, so to speak, because we're working from home, climate change, reports of CO2 emissions have actually bumped up quite an insubordinate bit to where we're seeing wildfires in the West Coast, even up to Canada and in Greece and Turkey and Portugal. And then Australia had their bushfires. And that was even just a little bit before their pandemic. And it's just truly shocking stuff.
Well,
truly shocking indeed.
I've looked at, you know, historically, a crisis like a pandemic, of course, you know, horrible, you know, nobody wants a pandemic, man. But in times of crises, we really see people reacting in ways that they wouldn't normally do. So early last year, when the pandemic hit and everybody went into lockdown, it was fascinating for me to see how many cities reacted quickly. Not every city, but there were many cities that reacted quickly. And here in Europe, it was certainly Milan and Paris who put in temporary bike lanes, Berlin as well. North American cities did some things there as well, Toronto, for example. But there was this, you know, it was the opportunity. In Milan, the politicians there said it best. They said, this is the window of opportunity. You know, we have all these plans on the table for bike lanes, and now we need them desperately. So bang, they slapped in all these, you know, temporary bike lanes, and they said, these are permanent. They're temporary right now with paint and bollards, but we're going to make them permanent. And they are in Paris as well. All of the temporary infrastructure they put in, I've been working in Paris a few times this spring. I mean, they're making it permanent now. They realize that there are people who will use it if you do it right, you know, if you really make the space and wider sidewalks as well. So, you know, one of the darlings for me is the capital of Lithuania, Vilnius. Sorry. They have a medieval city center, big public squares, lots of small restaurants and bars. So the mayor back in the 2020 said, fine, let's just make the world's largest cafe. We have to distance each other. So let's all move out onto the squares. And for now, it'll be free. We'll try and keep the businesses running as long as we can. You know, and everywhere around the world where you've seen these, you know, parking taken away to put out outdoor serving for restaurants, like New York is doing a great job with that. In the States, they're realizing, wait, there's a market for this. You know, in New York, they're saying nobody's going to sit out all winter, you know, and they did. They sat out all winter, you know, because they wanted to experience city life and they wanted to, you know, yeah, get back to kind of normal, as it were. And same thing here, even in Copenhagen, we have the bicycle infrastructure. We never had to put any more in because we were adequately prepared for a pandemic with bicycle infrastructure. We have the capacity to accommodate, you know, the people who didn't want to take the buses and the metro. So, but we have parking taken away and restaurants moving out into that space. And now that's going to be made permanent in many, many cases around the world. So that's really cool. We kind of realized, oh, cities are cool. You know, it's not just about trying, you know, to find, you know, more space for cars. It's actually trying to find more space for urban life. And so the positive aspect of the pandemic is really important to consider. That we have looked at our cities differently. And we're given the opportunity to act differently and quickly and efficiently and effectively. And that's been, I think, one of the greatest takeaways, you know, for me, is to observe all these things that are happening around the world. Then you got some cities that are now taking away their temporary bike lanes, you know, ooh, we got to put the cars back now, you know, but then you got the visionary cities that are saying, no, this is the age of change. This is the age of urbanism, man. This is our window of opportunity to make that positive change, force the positive change that we need and we deserve.
I think that is a very important thing to take into consideration as well. I definitely agree with you. Make with what you got, even in times of crisis there. I know, like you said, Copenhagen or Amsterdam, they already were ahead of the curve in this regard, so Portland, Oregon. But some places, it's a bit of a question mark here and there. I know, so I've been to I grew up in Great Britain, but I also grew up in the US, and things don't always seem the way it should be when it comes to channeling through cycling and environmental action, also road and urban planning public policy. It's a bit of a haphazard, probably a little bit more so in the US because it's car country. Now, with that being said, about the UK, I don't know if you're going to do a life-size city episode there, maybe you might, but what do you take on the Brexit matter, if that will affect anything in terms of their policy regarding urbanism and whatnot? Because I don't think it might work as planned, even though Boris Johnson likes to say, I'm doing cycling, you know, for TfL, really legend. Look at me, I'm riding a bike, I'm crazy.
He was like cooler as a mayor and then as a prime minister because he just got on his bike and went to work. Now he's real goofy and shit. But I mean, I don't know how Brexit's going to impact infrastructure. I do know that in the UK, there's been the highway code from like, I can't remember, like 1864. And there's rules in the highway code that still apply today. Like horses and carriages are still mentioned. Like that has been in desperate need of a drastic overhaul. And there are, it's on the table at the moment to update it, to prioritize cycling and walking in the UK's highway code. That's right. I've read about it just recently. So there might be some interesting developments there. Whether that has to do anything with Brexit, I doubt. But it is still a sign that there is still a momentum. You know, ever since I started in this game, not just cycling, I'm talking about, you know, life-size cities, right? There is a momentum, and I don't see it weakening. I see it, you know, continuing to roll. Not fast enough for my liking. I am an impatient idealist. I want things to happen faster. Because I know some cities that do it faster, so you know what's possible. But the momentum is there, man. So some cities are, you know, and some countries are slower. Like the U.S. is just still light years behind on the environment, on cycling infrastructure, on walkable cities. You know, it's a different system over there. You know, the politicians are afraid of not getting reelected. They're afraid of being, you know, visionary. In some cities, it's not the case. I mean, in New York, there was a great period. With Bloomberg and Jeanette Sadiq Khan as the transportation commissioner. Minneapolis has done really great work. Boston, Seattle, you know, there's some cities that you know are doing what they can. But
moving away from the car country. Moving away from the car country.
Yeah, it's a simple. It's, you know, to understand why it's like that in the States, transportation wise, it's quite simple. Traffic engineers, you know, in the 40s and 50s, when they all saw the car, everybody said the car is the future. Man, you know, traffic engineers were placed on a pedestal, and we need to, like, you know, not knock them off the pedestal, but take them down, you know, get them back to life, back to reality, sit them at a table with planners and designers and urban anthropologists and, you know, transport psychologists, and get them onto the team, which is the case in Scandinavia. You know, everybody's on the same team. Oh, you're the engineer. Cool. I'm the planner. I have some ideas. I know for a fact, because I've worked in so many cities around the world, that, you know, the engineers don't even want to talk to the planners. You know, oh, it's the damn urban designer. Oh, yeah. Fancy hippie thinking there. I got to build roads, man. And, you know, so that mentality, and it's the same in the big countries, in the UK, Germany, France, you know, Australia. It's like, you know, the traffic engineers are given way too much influence, and we need to just reel them in and get them to sit down and plan cities for the future, because what they've done over the past 70 years has failed miserably. It's killed people. It continues to kill people in so many different ways. Like, we know now, man, that little 7,000 years of urban history, and we screwed up so bad for 70, 80 years. And it's time that we fix it now, especially because we have a climate crisis, you know, a climate emergency. And the first place to fix that, to start fixing it, is the cities of the world. You have all your national politicians signing Paris treaties, and that's fine. But, man, you can start changing your neighborhood tomorrow and start reaping the benefits, you know, towards fighting the climate emergency. Like, we can do it like tomorrow. You know, national governments, they take years to decide things, and they have 20-year plans. I mean, I don't even know what they do. I don't care. You know, local politicians, local citizens, man, they can start making an impact in their own neighborhood, you know, fighting climate change tomorrow. And we know it's possible, right?
No, it definitely is there. With the right tools, and also the right sort of financial backing at hand, because unfortunately, money, root of all evil, but it also is the thing that often determines what gets in and what gets out. But I will agree with you with policy getting a bit too far ahead of itself. And I like you said about the window dressing thing with, you know, the sign of the Paris Climate Accord. Amazon's been putting all these crazy ads saying that we support promote the 10-year pledge. And then he goes to us that sort of vanity project of sending his Blue Apron spaceship up to the ionosphere. As you know, see, look at me. We didn't use the carbon emissions. That's not the right way to go about environmentalism, even if it seems like it is. Well, what do you think about the... Oh, no, go ahead. What are you going to say?
No. What, ask me the question, man. What do I think about what?
Environmental action on par of the... companies like Amazon and also Ford and Tesla, who are promoting all the e-vehicles on the roads. But I've been hearing, particularly on a very controversial documentary called Planet of the Humans, that they use the same fossil fuels that they use for combustible vehicles to make these e-vehicles. These Model S's, Model X's that you keep seeing on the roads, but that, I don't know, that might be a bit too controversial for you to say.
I mean, electric cars, man. You know, all the automobile industry and also the new players like Tesla and Elon Musk, you know, what a weird dude that guy is. But all they're doing is just replacing the cars we had with new cars. And then they're electric. Okay, great. That eliminates emissions. Great. But they still occupy urban space. They still run over people and kill them. They still make people feel unsafe in a city when they're blowing past at, you know, 30 miles an hour, 50 kilometers per hour, right? They still do all of these other things, which we don't want anymore. So it is one little aspect of it that they fixed. And then you have the whole problem with, I got a friend of mine in San Francisco. He's a professor. He's been researching electric energy. Like if every car in America was electric tomorrow, like that, you would need 50 new nuclear power plants to power all that electricity. Then you add to that the Bitcoin and all the, you know, all the servers and everything that they need. We have this outrageous demand for electricity, you know, and it's growing. I mean, nobody's figured that out. It's like we invented frozen food, but we haven't invented the freezer yet. Like, we don't know how to do it. So it's the same in Europe. We're going to need 50 nuclear power plants if all the cars went electric. And then where do the components come from? You know, nickel from Russia, lithium from South America, magnesium from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Like, you know, they're coming from weird places, and we're not questioning the working conditions, you know, the fact that we're just taking more stuff out of the earth. It's just different stuff we're taking out of the earth, man. And so it's just as like, you know, it's just a wolf in sheep's clothing all over again. So we know how to do things. You know, we have public transport. We have bicycles as solutions in cities, you know, combining the two as well. So we're still just staring into the last century thinking that was a good idea when, you know, there's other people, luckily, that are looking forward thinking, OK, we got to do things differently now because we screwed up so bad. And electric cars are just still screwing it up, right? Just with one little, you know, thing that's good about them is that they, you know, but totally the wrong mentality if we're going to plan our cities for the future. You know, I say we have to go back to the 50s. Before we invented the automobile, we were rational humans, right? We responded to the immediate needs of our citizens in our cities. The car came along and changed everything. We started thinking like, you know, huge motorways and, you know, national highway networks. Oh, we need parking now. You know, the first, it was really the biggest screw up in the history of Homo sapiens, putting cars into cities. You know, nothing before, nothing since has ever had such a massive impact on the way that we think about our cities. 7,000 years, the thinking was the same. Large and small cities was the same kind of ideology, the same kind of practical approach. Cars came along, screwed that up. It's time to go back to the future, back to a time when we were rational and intelligent human beings, knowing how to plan cities well, and take those ideas and put them into our cities today. That's really where we need to go now.
I get that. Very interesting in a good way. I think one can argue people have got a bit too ahead of themselves and are a bit more materialistic, a lot more so than they used to be. I think the advent of technology by all these entrepreneurs and also the two world wars we have been in and the influence of heavy giants like the US, France, and Britain with their colonial projects has made people more interested in, let's say, I'm doing this for the camera just to make everyone laugh. They're more influenced by this, by an iPad, an iPhone, than they are about protecting sycamore trees and oak bends. So that's just how I approach it. But I will say
I mean, like, anytime somebody says, oh, Silicon Valley is developing something, like, you know, then it's never a good idea. Apart from smartphones and stuff that I get your point, but we still use smartphones, right? Like, I live on my smartphone. I do all my work on my smartphone. I have my laptop here, fine. But I mean, there's the old saying, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. For, you know, most of human history, we only invented something if we needed it, right? Now you got these weird people in Silicon Valley inventing stuff that we don't need. They're only inventing it because we can, right? And that's not the way forward. You know, even smartphones, you know, all the Olympic medals in Japan, it's kind of cool. They gathered 6 million mobile phones and smartphones from the entire population for a few years, and they took all of the metals out of it. So the gold metal is made from gold that is in our old phones. So like we're still, you know, we still need gold and like certain components for electronics, right? But you know, we also have to just realize like, you know, we maybe need our phones, right? We've always needed a telephone ever since it was invented. So, and our computers are our way of the world. I'm talking to you now, right? But do we need all the other stuff? Do we need all of these electric batteries? Do we, you know, doing all these things? I don't have any kind of Alexa or any home, you know, whatever, all that fancy gadgets that everybody has in other countries. I got nothing, man. I got a phone and a computer. So like, we don't need, you know, we got to really reel it in. And we don't really live in the same kind of consumer society in the Nordic countries as perhaps in the United States. But still, there are people who are buying stuff that they don't need because, you know, they got money and, you know, it's kind of cool to have a thing, you know, whatever. But yeah, that's a big question, man. How do you tackle that, you know, consumerism, right? That's a tricky one.
Because I've been seeing a lot of waste going about, even in some of the more developing countries, for the next best thing. But you have to take into account as well, you know, someone who's living in East Timor, Timor Leste, or in Djibouti does not have an iPhone. That would cost him 5 years of work and then some to even obtain an iPhone, and probably his lifetime to even buy what would essentially be like a Mercedes C-Class. That's not going to happen. That sort of weird slur of inequality. To where it even brings people from more poor developing countries to want to work and live in the US and Britain, despite increasing immigration restrictions, because they want to feel like they want to be part of everything that's going on that's so great and so big. It is quite an unsettling matter. I often get into trouble with my friends and colleagues in regards to this because they think I'm some sort of dirty socialist lefty. And I tell them, well, I'm left-wing, but I'm not a Joe Biden, Keir Starmer type of left wing guy. I'm not in it just for the votes. I'm in it because I believe in him.
Well, I mean, on the other hand, like maybe not smart before smartphones came along, like Africa, man, they started getting mobile phones, and you know now on my phone I can do everything. But in Africa, they were doing everything before anybody else on the planet. You know, it was often the first telephone they ever had. They didn't have a landline, so they got a mobile phone. And they developed like the microloan concept, you know? Oh, it's super hot today. There's a traffic jam. A kid could like, you know, borrow money really quickly on his mobile phone from the shopkeeper, get a whole bunch of water, go out and sell it to all the motorists who are thirsty, and then bounce the money back to that dude. That was way before I could send money to my kids, you know, on my smartphone now. So like, it's been interesting to see how in the developing world, you know, how they took this first piece of technology that they ever had in their hand. And they did everything that we're doing. We learned from them. It's not often that happens, you know. It's usually the other way around. So, I mean, it's interesting once we get technology, how we can learn from each other. You know, like in Denmark, I live in the world's most digital nation. I've written an article about it, man. Like I haven't had cash in my hand in this country in like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. I don't see cash. The national government is trying to figure out how much money do we need, like printed money, because everybody's digital. Everything I need is on my phone. Everything's digital. My book called, you know, now I'm vaccinated, but every, you know, all my COVID tests, you know, I did like 30 of them here in Denmark, you know, it's all on the phone, you know, and then you show your barcodes and whatever, your QR codes. You know, so like, it's interesting how, you know, we've got a lot of that technology and the ideas for it from the developing world. So we also got to remember the other way around, right? How we can learn from each other in that sense. Yeah.
I would have definitely agree with you there. It may seem like, oh, we can climb everything as ourselves because we're Europe and North America. We're America. We're rich. We're white. We're powerful. We can do no wrong. But it had to come up from someone else's back to get even there. And even in the countries themselves that claim they're rich and powerful, they often rely on the facts of the poor. And, you know, typically ethnic minority and immigrant populations to get what they want. And I'm glad you kind of highlighted that on episodes of Life Size, like Copenhagen and New Orleans. And so on and so forth. I think that was very interesting. I love that also Parisian episode where you talk about one particular bon year that they usually don't refer to, but it was featured in films like Les Miserables, La Haine.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, every city has its issues, right? I mean, in Cape Town, like, you know, city like Cape Town, they have all of them all at once, you know, like, and then Paris has issues with, you know, with their view on immigration. And, you know, in Copenhagen, we have massive climate change adaptation. Like, you know, we're completely screwed by climate change over the past 15, 20 years, you know, we're adapting to it. And so every city has its issues, but, you know, there's another city that has the same issue. So we can, you know, absolutely look at each other and borrow the ideas like we did with all the great ideas coming out of Africa and the Middle East with their first mobile phones, because, you know, back then, like I said, like they had their first technology in their hand, and it was necessity is the mother of invention. What can I do with this thing? Here in the West, we're all like, oh, you know, I can buy stuff in my home. You know, I can buy an Alexa. I can do all that stuff. They're going, okay, this is important. What can I do with it? And they developed all of these cool ideas. So somewhere in the world, somebody has a great idea. And with the Lifestyle City, regarding cities, I'm trying to get that, you know, broadcast to a wider, you know, audience, right? And just look at their neighborhood going, nobody has any ideas for this problem here. Oh, wait, I just saw in Buenos Aires, they're doing that. That looks like our neighborhood. Let's do that. So, you know, again, it's the spider's web, connecting people. That's what the Lifestyle City can do.
And that is one of the favorite things about that particular show, not only because of the soundtrack, but also seeing you do the little things and learning from other cultures and countries, implement technology when they might not otherwise have the resources that we in the West, as some cultures put it, take for granted. I will say, in regards to the show itself, the tattoos. I know that's a large feature of the show. Do you do that mainly for, you know, because it's fun, or mainly just to show the connectivity that's within all of us?
Dude, I got a microphone here, but I mean, I started with Paris around the shoulder like years ago, right? And then I said, oh, that was kind of cool. Hang on, I'm going to fix the mic first. And then I added my favorite street in Montreal. I went, okay, I'll just slowly develop this. And then the TV series came along with my producer, and I'm just sitting at my wine bar here in Copenhagen, texting him, going, hey, dude, what about if I, you know, just get a piece of each city tattooed at the end of every episode, if I feel it, right? I don't have one from every city. But, and he just went, oh my God, would you do that? And I'm going, yeah, why not? You know, I'm 53, who cares, right? I think it's a cool idea. And it's a conversation point, you know. I take my work seriously as an urban planner, as an urbanist. You know, I got it under my skin, right? So yeah, it was kind of a crazy, stupid idea, which just kept kind of snowballing. And you know, we're in the middle of shooting season 4 when the pandemic hit, so we're going to resume filming season 4. I don't know when. Hopefully, the autumn here in 2021. But I'm kind of, I don't know where I'm going with it, man. It's just it's an organic thing. Oh, there's a little bit of space there. We'll squeeze something in. I don't have the big picture yet, but well, you know, I'll figure it out eventually. If we go to season 5 and 6, man, I'm screwed.
Oh yeah, you might even have to just like tattoo your own foot or something like that. It could be never ending. As far as suggestions are concerned, I would definitely like to see you head over to the UK. You could even be in Bristol, Manchester. They're my favorite cities, more so than London or Edinburgh, because Edinburgh is actually making better moves in terms of environmental policy and urbanism than London is. I don't know if it's because of the SNP, the Scottish National Government, under Nicola Sturgeon, or maybe just because they're a bit more connected with the European Union than their southern neighbors, who feel like, oh, we want to stamp our own rules and our own beliefs because the Brexit matter. But that's a side of it.
We, you know, planning where we're going to shoot, it's hard because there are many cities in the world. So in choosing cities, there's different things we have to think about. We need a geographic spread. We only do 6 episodes a season, so there's 6 places we got to go. We want a geographic spread, right? We don't want to just circle around Scandinavia. You know, that's going to be boring for everybody. So we want to go to Asia. We want to go to, South America, Central America, Europe, North America, whatever. So there's one thing. It has to be a geographic spread. And then the production company in Montreal, they had another series that they were doing. So around like a global travel series.
Is it Island Diaries or Chacun son île? Sophie Fouron, exactly. She's a good travel host as well.
Whoop, hang on, dropped something.
All right.
So there is logistics. They're sending a crew to film in India on an island. Okay, well then let's do Bangkok, because then the crew can fly in there, do the 1 week there and then fly to Bangkok and do 1 week and then go home. So a lot of it was logistics the whole way through. We have certainly talked about cities in the UK. I can't remember which ones made our shortlist. We talked about London, but we also like to do cities that are unusual that you don't normally think about, you know,
like Hamilton in Ontario.
Yeah, that was a weird one. It was also a mid-sized city. So I don't think we'd ever go to Bristol because we realized that we need a city of a certain size to fill 1 hour of television. So you can't just go to a small city, you know, like a little weird Dutch city or something, because there's not enough content, not enough things happening in that city to fill an hour of TV. So we need larger cities. And we filmed in Los Angeles and then the pandemic struck. So I can't even remember the other cities that we were planning. It's like a year and a half ago now. I think Lagos was one of them. Certainly Antwerp in Belgium, Berlin. And then we were looking at some other cities. I can't remember what they are. And that might change now because, you know, where can we travel with the pandemic? We're done with it here in Denmark, but, you know, in other places, it's still pretty hard hit. So, you know,
there's
still a lot of logistics, right? And it has to be a place where stuff is happening, you know? It has to be a place where people are doing stuff. Like, we went into Bangkok, and I'm going, man, our researcher, she's like a legendary researcher in Canadian TV. But I'm going, what are you going to find in Bangkok, the asphalt jungle, man? There's nothing there. Boom, she just drags people out of the woodwork and says, this guy's doing really amazing stuff. That girl, man, she's doing cool stuff, you know? And she's really the reason that we have so much good content is our researcher. And then we got to piece together, like I said, the logistics and all the other things. So it's not easy, you know, it's not just throwing darts at a dartboard and say, let's go there. You know, there's a lot of background thought put into it.
I figured that was the way there. I know when the parts are unknown and no reservations, Anthony Bourdain, they had to think about, okay, where to go in this particular bit, because what's the budget from CNN and Travel Channel? So they had to be quite careful. But I'm sure it's probably even more difficult because most Canadian television I'm aware of, so I used to watch a lot of it back as a child, like Atomic Betty and Ed, Edd n Eddy and Beach Combers. I love Canadian programs. They're government funded mostly, from what I'm aware of. So it's quite difficult compared to like US productions, which are mostly privately financed. And also there's that English French language issue. So you probably would unsure whether to approach it as an English language program or a French language program. So Sophie Fouan, she dubs it into two versions.
Yeah. I mean, it's TV Ontario who finance the series, right? And then we take it and we sell it to other broadcasters. I think 20 different broadcasters around the world now and counting. But it's TV Ontario. So it's English language because it's primarily an English language province. So it's been shown in France and in Quebec. And then I think they dub it there for some reason. But it was never a question of whether it's English or French. It was always going to be an English language production because the main broadcaster is in a primarily English language province. But yeah, it's a government, it's a public service channel, right? But yeah, then we sell it around the world. But it's a lot of public service channels that have bought it. And it's weird how it becomes really popular in certain places, you know, in Belgium, in Finland, you know, it's like incredibly popular. You know, I walk down the street in Belgium, you know, and it's like, I've seen that show. It's like, why did that appeal to the Belgians and, you know, maybe not the Greeks? You know, I have no idea, nobody knows. But it, you know, I mean, when we were planning it, man, you know, cause like it's my network, you know, my silo, you know, it's all urbanists. So they know a lot of this stuff, but I always said this has to be an accessible program for the family sitting in their sofa on the Sunday night, watching each episode. I want to inspire the regular people. So, you know, that was always the goal. Is the people who don't know anything about urbanism, but they live in a city and they go, wow, that's like my city, except that's Tokyo. Wow, but there's similarities and wow, we can do these kind of things. And then I'm walking down the street in Toronto a couple of years ago and this guy says, hey, you know, Michael Cole Anderson. I'm going, hey, what's up, man? He says, oh, we love your show. And I turn and he has a whole family, his wife, two young daughters. And he says, oh, my older daughter, she's going to hate me because she wasn't here. You go, you all watched the show? Like, you know, you like 11, 13 year old and all going, oh my God. Yeah. So like, I realized then that we nailed it, right? We hit it. We nailed that family. Right. And other families around the world. So it's not just my tribe, you know, the urbanites going, oh my God, that's so interesting. It's like the regular people. And that was always the goal. And, you know, I mean, I heard about He keeps talking about Anthony Bourdain. Like, he's not a household name in Europe at all. And I started getting called that, Anthony Bourdain of urbanism, you know, and I'm going, okay. So I had a look at what he does back when we were starting. And I'm going, oh, this guy's pretty cool. I don't have any heroes. I don't have any like actors or actresses or anything that I, oh my God, I want to meet them one day. I don't really care. That guy, I'm going, damn, I want to drink with that guy one day. I'm just going, he was cool. I've never tried to be him because I am, as I think you can see in the program, I'm just me.
Yeah, no, you're your own individual. But the comparison I've made was mainly because you men of a certain age, and you're very cool. You talk about travel and culture and politics all as one. He's more food oriented because he's a chef.
We both have ink, and we both swear a lot, and we both don't give a shit. You know, like, you know what I mean? And so I had learned who he was and had seen a lot of his stuff. And I remember we were filming in Detroit. We were filming the Detroit episode, and we woke up in the morning on our phones, me and the crew, and the news hit that he had died. And we all just came down to breakfast. We were like, we were gutted, man.
I was gutted.
I've never been like so emotionally impacted by the death of a celebrity. Like, seriously, ever. I don't, you know, it's sad when people die. Sure, their family's sad. That dude, man, I'm going, damn, you know, I'm never going to drink with him. You know what I mean? The whole crew was gutted.
Well, I could know because they have connections with working on travel shows and shows that talk about politics and culture. And he was kind of in that same vein. And to see him, you know, sort of hang himself in the French-German border, it was quite shocking indeed. I know they've done a documentary recently about him. That was a bit controversial because they used an AI or deepfake for his voice. But
only three lines, but still, yeah.
I saw it. I actually thought it was very good and respectful to his character. I kind of ignored the fact that they did use the free manipulate lines with his voice. So, like, you get the idea there. But more or less, Anthony Bourdain, are you closer in spirit to... You got two people here. Bradley Wiggins, famous cyclist, Olympics, or Michael Palin?
What am I supposed to do with these people?
Who are you closer in spirit to?
Bradley Wiggins, I don't give a shit about cycling. He's like, dude, he's some spandex dude who rides really fast in mountains. I don't care. Michael Palin, if I have to choose between those two, it's Michael Palin, man. Monty Python and his travel shows, which I have actually seen, totally. You know, I don't know who this Wiggins guy is, and I don't care if I ever meet him in my life, but Palin would be awesome to drink with. You know, that's how I judge people, what I want to drink with them. That's how I choose my politicians in Copenhagen in the national elections is like, you know what? I could drink with that person. They would sit down with me and they would be nice, interesting to drink with and not all boring and politician-y or boring and racing cyclist kind of guy, you know? So yeah, no, I'm going with Palin there, man.
I'd go with Palin too. He's done New York and around the world in 80 days. So I was a big fan of, unfortunately, I haven't seen Sahara or the Himalaya ones that he did for the BBC, but I'll definitely check those out. And certainly a lot more of your stuff too, because one of the other things I love about Life Size is not only the travel and the culture stuff, but also the music. That funky electronica and bass lines and down tempo. I'm thinking, do you make the music yourself?
No. That, I can do a lot of things, man, creatively, but music is not one of them. There's a guy in Montreal, friends of the executive producer, and he's just like, he just jams that music, man. And after the first season, we were nominated for like 5 Canadian Screen Awards, you know, and music was one of them. And that was obvious, man, because it is so cool. You know, he's got like, you know, he hits everything with that music. So I listen to it a lot because if I'm editing for the Life Size City YouTube channel, and I'm putting some small clips out there. I'm hearing the music all the time. Never gets old, man. I never get tired of hearing it. So it's really cool. I'm glad you noticed the music, right? Because everybody else talks about the urbanism and stuff, but the music is definitely a... And I think the great thing, maybe that, you know, maybe somebody like you notices it, but that other people don't notice it is a very good thing, right? I hated the music in that show. Or, you know, like, you know, it's like, if you don't notice it, then he's doing his job well. It just supports the rest of the, you know, it's the pillars on which the visuals... stand, you know what I mean? So, but I'm glad you noticed it, dude.
Hey, you're very welcome. For a show that about environmentalism, culture, and politics, it definitely has one of the most interesting soundtracks I can think of because I also make music myself, and I love the sound of the bass, particularly on the first verse was like, you could be a member of Parliament Funkadelic if ever they do like a reunion. Oh, yeah. George Clinton's still alive, man. just tell him I said that. I love his music. J'aime beaucoup de musique. If he's a French speaking Canadian, I also speak French myself, but I didn't want to do the interview in French because English seems like the most global language. I'm sure in Denmark, because you speak three or two languages.
Who? Me?
Yes.
How many? I don't know how many. I never thought about how many languages I speak. When do you speak a language? Like, how do you? Like, what is the qualification for saying I speak a language?
Well, because I was thinking, because I love France so much and I would like to travel there again, but I would be a little bit worried myself, like, oh no, because I don't know it to the highest level. I'd be like, talking to my subjects, oh no, I would miss certain cues and idioms they might use.
That's the question. When do we know a language? When can I say I speak a language? I mean, I think if I can get by conversationally, maybe I speak a language. So then I don't know, what do I speak, man? Six or seven languages or something, I think. And then I understand a lot of other languages. Like I understand a lot of German, like in a conversation, I totally get most of it. I don't know how to speak it as well back, but so I don't know if I speak German. So I don't know how to qualify it, but I mean, I can be anywhere really in Europe and follow most conversations except like Finland and Greece and Hungary and places like that, where the languages are so different. But, you know, I've never thought about how many languages I speak.
Because, most of the Scandinavian people I've met, particularly those who are from Norway and Sweden, their English is so great. They're even better than most French people I've met, because that's a country I love quite well. They even speak better English than some people who I know back from home, who speak sort of like a rough tongue.
You know what the thing is? It's a small country, right? It's also the educational system in Scandinavia. But like the countries that speak the best English as a second language in Europe are Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, the Netherlands, the small countries. Also because we don't dub anything. You know, everything that you grow up with is subtitled. And then we know there's a lot of science about language where if you subtitle everything, you can learn languages much quicker. And also like, you know, my kids have English from, my kids are bilingual because I speak English to them, but, and they speak Danish back to me, but kids get English from the first grade here in Denmark. And then they start learning a second language in the fifth grade, a third language, I guess. So, I mean, like languages is on the curriculum from, you know, the first day you walk into school. So, you know, if you live in a big country like France or Germany, you know, you have a huge cultural bubble that you live in. If you live in France, you know, you got French culture coming from Quebec, from Africa, you know, from all the other French territories. You don't very often have to go out of that bubble. If you live in a small country, it's a very small bubble. So you want to break out of that and you want to be able to go somewhere and speak another language. So it's kind of a survival instinct to know lots of languages in the small countries in Northern Europe, right? And it's just an amazing benefit to know many languages, to be able to walk into another country and understand and speak, right? So. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Because I'd say like to head over back to Suomi or Finland. Many of my friends, more or less from my mother's side, grew up there, and they often like to conversate in Finnish in English. Sometimes in a way that almost sounds a little too much like they use certain idioms or slang that they get from American television, which I think was pretty funny. They were saying, "How's it going, man?" And his name was. Like Johan Markela, which I thought was pretty funny. I'll definitely like to see you do an episode in Helsingfors or Helsinki or Espoo. That would be pretty interesting.
Helsinki, man. I'm going to work there in 2 weeks, so I haven't been back for a couple of years, so I'm looking forward to going to Helsinki. It's a cool ass town, man. Really cool. We'll figure it out.
Well, I wish you the best of luck there. And I'll also say, through Lifesize City, with that show, did they commission it on the basis of the Copenhagen Eyes book or maybe through your blog?
I mean, the Lifesize City is not really, I mean, the Lifesize City is totally separate in a way. The Copenhagen Eyes, the book, is about how to create a cycling city. It's the ultimate guidebook for, you know, taking the bicycle seriously as transport, you know, and that came out of the blog. Then all my thinking started to broaden about, you know, how, what else we need in cities apart from bikes, you know, and that's many things. So the Lifestyle City sort of appeared, you know, years ago as a catchphrase. I was walking around the neighborhood with my kid, my daughter. She was like, you know, 4 and a half at the time. And she was, we're just walking along, waiting to cross the street, holding hands. And she looked up at me out of the blue and said, "Daddy, when is my city going to fit me? When is my city going to fit me?" And I'm going, "Wow, yeah, you're little. You're tiny." And of course, the city seems like it doesn't fit you. It seems like it was designed for adults. And then, man, I just started thinking about that for like weeks. I was obsessed by it. And I said, "Does my city fit me?" And I'm traveling, I'm going, does that city fit me here? You know, and I realized that that is, you know, I gave it a name. I said, I got to honor this amazing urban observation from a 4 and a half year old. I said, the city should be life-size. Everybody in the city should feel like the city fits them. Whether you're 4 and a half, whether you're 99, or whether you're everybody in between, man. So that became the phrase, which became the most obvious name for the TV series, because that's what it's all about, right? So yeah, that sort of came out of left field, you know? And now that's what I do, really, more than anything else, is thinking about the life-size city, kid-size cities, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I thought that was a great source of inspiration there that came from your child, because I know when I was growing up, I was a big geography nerd myself. I always got a mark or a grade A back in school and university in geography, but not so much geology. And I always was obsessed looking at the maps and atlases, like seeing, okay, I can hop to this bit right here, hop to that bit right there. I go for this particular motorway, all these passes. And then, you know, as I got a bit older, I learned about this sort of cultural and political conflicts and complexities that surround the world as we see fit. And I realized it can be a very interesting place to be, but also an ugly one. And you saying life-size city, it kind of harkens back to, maybe this is just me. Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels, Lilliputians. Am I the only one to think that?
Yeah, probably.
Oh no, I'm a bit old.
Cool, but... And it's cool. Never heard that one, but that's fun.
Yeah, I even had to include the bit at the end where you show your phone. It's like, I love the soundtrack too much. I probably shouldn't though. I probably should like everything else about it as well. And this might be the last question for the audience out there: is for all the people who you interview as subjects and want to talk about, how can they get involved on the particular show? Because I would definitely like to meet you at one point in time to discuss about British or American or even Canadian urbanism or cultural, political issues as we see fit. How can they get involved?
I mean, if, to be on the show, the researcher, like I said, finds these people in these cities, right? And when we started, you know, back in season one, we were thinking we're going to get a lot of, you know, politicians and my colleagues, like planners and architects. But then very early on, we realized that it is the citizens, man. The citizens are just taking matters into their own hands. And they have become, they've completely hijacked the series. Every time we're looking at a city, we're finding like some citizen-led project, just a group of families on one little street in a suburb of Buenos Aires that we've never heard of. And they're doing stuff that can be transferred, you know, into any other city in the world. So if you want to get on the show, you got to do some really cool stuff, you know, in a city that we're going to go and film in, you know what I mean? Or, you know, watching what these people are doing and, you know, applying it in the neighborhood that you live in with your neighbors. You know, that's what the show is, man. It's inspiration. It's just people around the world doing amazing things. And the reason for that is that we can transfer it into other urban contexts. So, you know, oh, you got to be doing really cool stuff to get on the show if we're going to your city, you know?
And oh, yes, of course.
Luckily, it's tough competition because there's so many people doing so many great things.
I probably wouldn't qualify on my end, but I probably would know a few people who would probably do the same too. I think what you were doing on this particular show and also for the other projects that you might be having is absolutely wonderful stuff. And I don't know very many TV shows at this time that are quite like that. I think you have filled a void in my heart and my mind that cannot be replicated by a Game of Thrones or Umbrella Academy, all this other crap you see on Netflix and Sky Atlantic, HBO. I think you're definitely one of a kind. I probably should be comparing a fiction show to a non-fiction, but I don't know. Every one of my friends that I know keeps talking about these types of shows. And they're talking about, you know, Bridgerton as well. I just can't relate to any of these programs, but I can relate to travel shows. I can definitely relate to you and any of the other programs that are in that sort of camp. I watch it with my mother all the time. She likes the soundtrack too, and she also likes a lot of the sort of humor that's or interspersed when you least expect it, and you getting the tattoos because he's like, hey, that's a bit kind of a vanity project, isn't it? And I'm like, shut up. But it's definitely nice to have you on board, and I wish the best luck there.
Thank you very much.